Okay, so you know how we always talk about how the 2008 financial crisis, I mean, it feels like forever ago, but like it's still so relevant, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the ripple effects are still playing out, you know?
Totally. And a huge part of that whole mess was mortgage-backed securities, right? Like understanding that whole world is crucial for anyone in law, especially now with everything that's going on.
Right. I mean, that's why we're diving into this FHFA v. Nomura case today.
Yeah, this case is, it's not just some random lawsuit after the crisis. It was huge, right? I mean,
Right.
$806 million judgment, that's not nothing.
Exactly. And it really clarified some important stuff about securities law, which, you know, for you folks out there studying law, this is like essential knowledge.
For sure. And that's exactly what we're aiming for in this deep dive, right? We want to break down this case, see what makes it so important for understanding securities law, and let's be honest, how these sometimes shady securitization deals actually work. So first things first, gotta set the stage.
Right, so the Federal Housing Finance Agency, the FHFA, they were basically the caretakers for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac after, you know, everything went down.
Right, those government-sponsored enterprises, the GSEs, the ones that basically keep the housing market afloat.
Exactly. So the FHFA, they sued Nomura and RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, over seven of these residential mortgage-backed securities deals, these RMBS things from like 2005 to 2007.
Okay, so set the stage for us. What were they accusing Nomura and RBS of doing?
Basically, they said that the offering documents, the info given to investors, it was full of lies.
Lies, like what?
Like, they said there were misrepresentations about how good the mortgage loans actually were. Like, they lied about the underwriting standards, you know, how they decided who got a loan in the first place. They lied about loan-to-value ratios, so basically how much people borrowed compared to what their houses were actually worth.
Wow, so they were making the loans look way better than they really were.
Exactly. They also messed with stuff about whether the borrowers actually lived in the houses, you know, like were they really owner-occupied, and they even fudged data given to the credit rating agencies.
So it was basically like a house of cards built on deception.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And Fannie and Freddie, they invested a ton in these securities, over $2 billion. And then, boom, the crisis hits and these things just
You
tank.
have huge losses, right?
Huge. It really shows you how big the impact was.
Yeah, and it's crazy. Our sources said this Nomura case was the only one out of 16 similar cases that actually went to trial.
Yeah, think about that. All those other institutions, they settled. It makes you think Nomura really thought they had a good case, or maybe it was just that much more complex.
Yeah, and the district court, they sided with the FHFA after a bench trial, and then the Second Circuit, they upheld that decision. So this case, it's not just some random case. It really tells us a lot about how the law works after a crisis like that.
Absolutely. Okay, so we've got the background. Now let's get into the legal stuff.
Yeah, the nitty-gritty. What were the actual legal claims that the FHFA made?
So the main one was under Section 12A2 of the Securities Act of 1933. This one's super important. It basically says if you sell securities and you lie in the documents, like the prospectuses, you can be held responsible.
Makes sense. So you can't just say whatever you want to get people to invest.
Nope, there are consequences. They also went after them under Section 15, which is about control person liability.
Control person liability, what's that?
So it means if you're like the boss and someone under you breaks securities law, you can be held liable too, even if you didn't directly do it. Like if you knew about it or should have known and didn't stop it.
Oh, so it's like you're responsible for what your people do.
Right. They also threw in some claims based on state laws, you know, blue sky laws from Virginia and DC, which basically do the same thing as the federal securities law.
So they really went after them on all fronts. But Nomura and RBS, they didn't just roll over, did they?
No, they fought back. One of their main arguments was about time, you know, the statute of limitations and the statute of
Oh,
repose.
hey, remind me, what are those again?
So the statute of repose is like a hard deadline. 3 years from when the securities were first offered, that's it. No more claims after that, doesn't matter what.
Okay, and the statute of limitations.
That's about when you discover the problem. You have 1 year from when you realize there was a lie, but it still has to be within that 3 year repose period.
So Nomura was saying the FHFA waited too long.
Exactly. But here's where things get interesting. The FHFA countered with the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008, HERA.
Hey, Chair, what's that?
It's this law that has something called an extender statute for cases like this.
So it extends the time limit.
Yep. Specifically for the FHFA to go after people for Fannie and Freddie's losses from the crisis. It basically overrides those normal time limits.
Yeah.
And this is a big deal because it sets a precedent for all those cases that came after the crisis.
Wow, so HRA really changed the game.
Big time. Then there's the reasonable care defense under Section 12A2.
Okay, break that down for me.
Basically, it says if you can prove you did your due diligence, you know, you really looked into things and had no reason to think you were lying, then you're not liable.
So Nomura said, hey, we did our homework. We didn't know anything was wrong.
Yep, that's their argument. But the court wasn't buying it.
How not? I mean, if they really did do their due diligence.
Here's the thing. The court said the way Nomura sampled and reviewed the loans was totally inadequate. They didn't look at enough of them, and they ignored some obvious red flags.
So they were cutting corners.
Basically. But here's the real kicker. The court said Nomura focused too much on credit risk.
Credit risk? What's that?
Basically, they were trying to figure out if the borrowers would pay back the loans. They weren't actually checking if the information they gave investors was actually true. You know, like, were those underwriting standards really followed? Were the loan-to-value ratios accurate?
So they were worried about the wrong things.
Yeah, they missed the whole point of due diligence. It's not just about assessing risk. It's about being honest with investors.
That's a big distinction.
Huge. Okay, so let's move on to the legal issues the court had to deal with.
Yeah, there were four big ones, right?
Right. Number one, the timeliness. The court really emphasized how HERA, with its extender statute, allowed the FHFA to bring the case. This is a big takeaway for anyone dealing with post-crisis litigation.
Got it. What about the second issue?
That was about what Fannie and Freddie actually knew. Nomura said, hey, these guys were sophisticated. They knew the whole industry was getting riskier.
So they couldn't claim they were tricked.
That was the argument.
Mm.
But the court said, no, just knowing things are generally bad doesn't mean you specifically knew about Nomura's lies.
It's like knowing there's a flu going around doesn't mean you know you're going to get it.
Exactly. You have to prove they knew about the specific problem.
Okay, makes sense. Issue number three.
The right to a jury trial. Nomura and RBS said they should have had a jury, but the court said, nope, not for this kind of claim.
Why not?
Because Section 12A2 claims are considered equitable, not legal.
Equitable, legal, what's the difference?
It's kind of complicated, but basically, equitable claims are about fairness, like getting things back to how they should be, and the main thing they wanted here was rescission.
Rescission, what's that?
It means basically unwinding the deal, putting everyone back where they were before they bought the securities, and that kind of relief, it's handled by equity courts. No jury needed.
So it's a totally different system.
Yep, and it's important to understand that difference.
Yep.
Okay, last issue. Liability and damages. The court looked at all the evidence and agreed that a crazy amount of loans, over 45%, were defective.
So they basically confirmed Nomura was lying.
Yep, and that high rate of bad loans, it was key to proving liability. And for damages, they went with a rescission-based approach.
So they tried to put Fannie and Freddie back where they started.
Exactly. Make them whole again.
Now, what about loss causation? Didn't Nomura try to blame the crisis for everything?
Yeah, they said even if they messed up, the real losses came from the 2008 crash, not their little lies.
So it was like, don't blame us, blame the earthquake.
Right, but the court was like, no way. They said the crisis wasn't some random act of God. It was directly tied to all those misrepresentations about mortgages.
So they were basically saying, you helped cause the earthquake, you can't blame it for the damage.
Exactly. And they even had this great line in the opinion. They said, defendants may not hide behind a market downturn that is in part their own making.
Love it.
Right. It's like, you can't start a fire and then be surprised when stuff burns down.
So big picture, what does this Nomura case mean for future securities litigation?
Well, for one, it really solidified HERA's power. You know, overriding those statutes of repose, that's a big deal for the government's ability to respond to financial crises.
Makes sense. What else?
It clarified who counts as a statutory seller under Section 12A2, and that includes those RMBS depositors, the ones who package the loans. That means more people can be held liable.
Oh, so they're closing loopholes?
Right. And maybe most importantly, it set a high bar for due diligence. It's not enough to just check for credit risk. You got to actually make sure the info you give investors is true.
So it's about real accountability.
Exactly. This case is like a blueprint for how to do materiality analysis right. They looked at the hard numbers, the percentage of bad loans, and they also considered the bigger picture, like how risky those defects were for investors.
So it's not just about the numbers, it's about the context.
Precisely.
It makes you wonder, could this same reasoning apply to other areas like crypto or ESG stuff?
That's a million-dollar question, right? Could those Nomura principles, like the due diligence and the link between lies and market risk, could they apply to these new crazy financial products? It's something to think about as these markets grow and the regulators start paying attention.
So summing it all up, what are the key takeaways for our listeners, the future legal eagles?
All right, number one, you got to know those timelines for bringing securities claims, especially with laws like HAA that can change everything. Two, remember those Section 12A2 claims. They're equitable, not legal. Big difference for your rights. And three, always be accurate and thorough with your disclosures. Don't lie and make sure you actually check the facts.
Great advice. And to leave you with something to chew on, remember how the court really focused on that link between Nomura's lies and the crisis? Think about this. How could future plaintiffs use that same argument for cases involving new financial products? You know, could they say that misleading statements about some newfangled investment contributed to a whole new kind of systemic meltdown?
It's a thought-provoking question, especially as the financial landscape continues to evolve.
It is. And on that note, that's a wrap for our deep dive into FHFA v. Nomura. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.